Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories in the news. We'll begin, in fact, with the major story, which is today's elections in Mexico. We will begin with a spokesperson for Yo Soy 132, the student movement that began as a reaction to Mexico's media monopoly's promotion of the pre-presidential candidate Peña Nieto. Paula Santoyo, who emceed last night's massive silent protest in the Zócalo, joins us. Then we will speak with Dr. Andre Dorsey Ramos, who is a lecturer at the Communications Science Department in the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico and is the ombudsman for Public Broadcasting Channels 22. We will discuss the flagrant political bias of Mexico's media monopolies and how much the alternative media used by Yo Soy 132 is penetrating the political landscape. Then George Grayson, the author of The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Have Created, joins us to discuss the impact of the bloody and brutal war on drugs on Mexico's election. Then finally, Anne-Marie O'Connor joins us. She writes for The Washington Post from Mexico City, and we will discuss the unlikely possibility of an upset victory by the PRD candidate, López Obrador, who she recently profiled in The Washington Post. Joining us now is Paula Santoyo, who is a university student studying economics at ITAM in Mexico City. She's been with the Yo Soy 132 movement from the beginning and was the MC at last night's massive silent protest in the Zócalo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paula Santoyo.
Hello, how are you doing? Hello to everyone in your auditorium. I've got to say, right now we're hosting this thing called Room of Peace. There's about 50 of us, and we're all equipped with computers monitoring the election to make sure we effectively communicate all the irregularities or any, you know, breaches of the law to the authorities and to the global media.
So already there's been reports that the PAN have accused the PRI of giving away, I think, 9,500 prepaid gift cards to voters. Is that one of the violations going on?
Yes, and it's not just that the PRI is buying or has been buying for the last month an enormous amount of votes. Even today, in Mexico, we have this thing called veda electoral, in which there's a law that states that no one is allowed to make any pronunciation during the day of the election or the 3 days before that. And today, just before voting, Peña Nieto's addressed an audience, and I mean, that's breaking the law, and he instructed people to vote for the PRI. And we're having other incidents as well. There's been 3 reported deaths in other states of Mexico, and already risks of votes being, like, the whole casilla, the whole place. This is happening in Tamaulipas. They're stealing all the votes, not just one or two. I mean, the whole infrastructure there, all the votes. It's really dramatic. And, it's just the beginning. We're hoping to catch all these people. Actually, we're using hashtag. We're using Twitter obsessively to report all this. And we're using this hashtag called I Caught You, 132. Te caché 132.
So tell us, Paula Santoyo, since you've been with the Yo Soy 132 student movement from the beginning, that it was created, I understand, in response to an appearance by the pre-candidate Peña Nieto at a student meeting where he was roundly booed by the students, but the coverage on television ignored all of this. And then a group of students did a YouTube where they basically, the 131 of them, and said, no, we this actually happened, and we are the ones that did it, and this is true. And then you, the extra letter, 132, can join the movement. Is that a brief description of it?
Yeah, that's a brief description. Actually, we were all very eager, you know, listening to this interview, well, this appearance of Peña Nieto at Universidad Iberoamericana, which is, we have to say, is really like a posh school, it's private, and you wouldn't expect, you know, these students to be so active politically, I mean, yeah? So we were listening to this interview, and suddenly, well, these people were, all these students were organized, but also there was like personal inclination, you know, like they just wanted to say out loud that they didn't agree with him or what he had done before, mainly accusing him of what he did in Apenco in 2006, huge repression, social repression. So it was this that happened first, and then they threw him out of the university basically because he said he was using the force of the state to maintain peace, and all his actions were, you know, perfectly legal, and he was doing nothing wrong. So the students threw him out, and then what was absolutely infuriating was that the president of the party, of the PRI, called and said that these were not students, they were trained people from the left party, the PRD, and they were trained and they weren't students at Ibero. So all the students and the friends I know, they were there, they couldn't believe it. And this was being, you know, like world, like, well, not world news, but national news. Like, no, nothing happened. Peña Nieto had a really successful visit here at the university. And these people that started shouting at him are not representative. So it was not just that. So the students first did this video, this 131 students. And then what happened is that the PRI started threatening them. So the other private universities, such as mine, ITAM, we started, you know, communicating with our friends from Ibero and saying, okay, we're going to support you and we're not going to let this happen. And not just the threats, but also, well, I'm telling you that nationally, like, people didn't know about it. In Twitter, we found out, obviously, but most adults didn't know about it and just read the news, the papers, and they all said, oh, really successful visit, and everything's going perfect. So we were furious, and we started, you know, pointing at these two media, well, it's a monopoly.
Televisa and Azteca.
Right. So, and we started pointing at them because it was them that were manipulating the truth, and they were not, you know, letting people know that we were doing this. We were standing up and we were shouting, we don't want this regime back in our country. Sure. So that's how it started, and after that, all the universities joined up, and it was not. It started with us shouting at Peña Nieto for what he had done, but I think what really joined us and what really gave, you know, momentum to this movement was the fact that we didn't want media to manipulate us, and we want them to say the truth, you know, to speak the truth.
Well, of course, there's an irony here that the PRI ruled Mexico for almost the exact amount of time that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union ruled the Soviet Union, and they used exactly the same techniques in terms of media control, although Mexico is nominally, supposedly a free and democratic society. Tell us again, Paula Santoyo is a university student studying economics at ITAM in Mexico City, and she's been with the Yo Soy 132 student movement from the beginning and was the MC at last night's massive silent protest in the Zocalo. Tell us about what happened last night in the Zocalo.
Well, last night was truly a really emotional experience. We started from Tlatelolco, which is a huge plaza that was sort of host to the 1968 student movement here in Mexico, and where in October of 1968, There was a huge repression, and lots of students were killed. And also in those days, well, obviously, the news was completely manipulated. So we started off at that plaza, sort of remembering this students. And then we continued along to Televisa, to the headquarters of Televisa. And there, it was unbelievable because there were policemen, as never before, like three rows surrounding the whole building because they were so afraid we would do something. They took off all the propaganda surrounding the building, and it was just the building there stripped, and lots of students shouting with... And not just shouting, but they started shouting there because they were absolutely furious at the network, you know. But after that, we decided we would take this route to Zócalo in absolute silence. So we made sort of formations with candles, all in, you know, in a single line. And we started marching slowly to Zócalo. When we arrived, we were also joined by people from Atenco, which is this place I told you about that was seriously repressed in 2006. And all these people, which are, you know, like, they're not students. They're actually grown-ups that have been fighting since 2006 because they wanted to put an airport in their land, and they wanted to take their land, and they refused, and for that they were killed. So yesterday they were with us, and we were all, you know, absolutely silent. We're all with candles and fire, and it was just so emotive and so inspiring. And we started entering Zócalo thinking, okay, we won't be that many, but it's enough. But we couldn't believe our eyes, because when we started surrounding the flag, we saw people coming and coming and coming. It is said, this is not an official number, but about 200,000 people there. And everyone was silent, just waiting for us to, you know, give a speech or something. And we couldn't believe what we were seeing. The images are just appalling, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Paula, I'm afraid we've run out of time today, but I really appreciate you joining us and telling us about the movement that you're a part of, and the extent to which you're trying to break through the controlled media in Mexico to get your message out. We really appreciate your joining us.
And, well, I want to thank you and all your audience for hearing us and for putting your eyes in Mexico during this day. It is very important for us to have media from other countries or just citizens concerned with, you know, the speaking the truth. And, you know, we hope this election goes smoothly and we have the president that we actually voted for.
Again, I thank you for joining us. Paula Santoyo is a university student studying economics at ITAM in Mexico City. She's been with the Yo Soy 132 movement from the beginning and was the MC at last night's massive silent protest in the Zócalo. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking further about Mexico's media monopolies.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dr. Andre Dorce Ramos, who's a lecturer and researcher at the Communication Sciences Department in Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico. He researches the media and political culture, especially in relation to media production and consumption in the emerging digital media landscape. His interests are focused on the role of communications technology on society and politics, and he's a member of the executive board of the Union of Socially Committed Scientists, where he coordinates the Media and Communication Group. He's also the ombudsman for Public Broadcasting Channel 22 and is currently working on a book about critical perspectives on media convergence, collaborating with several local and regional initiatives for progressive change in media legislation in Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Andre Dorce Ramos.
Hello. Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
So tell me about today, for example, one of the factors in turnout. There is expected to be not the usual turnout, which has been very high in Mexico, something akin to what we have here in the United States, around between 60 and 70%. Is the weather a factor in turnout, or people are just fed up with politics?
Well, generally, I'd say the second option is the right answer. Most people are actually fed up with the political class in Mexico, so I don't think the weather is going to be quite a factor, a decisive factor today. But we're in a point now in Mexican history where we are not really sure of exactly what's going to happen. I mean, it can go either way. I think I personally think it's going to be a big turnout.
So the turnout, of course, would indicate some enthusiasm for the PRD candidate, López Obrador. He's supposed to be gaining in the polls, but most of the polls indicate that Peña Nieto is fairly well ahead, sometimes by double digits. Exactly. What's your hunch on this?
Well, you know, it's always difficult with polls and statistics and et cetera, et cetera. And Mexico has had a kind of complicated history with that. Last election, 2006, only one of the main surveys was correct about Presidente Calderón actually getting into the presidency. So there's a lot of skepticism about those numbers, I'd say. And also, it's important to say that the rate of denial, the amount of people that don't want to answer these surveys is huge, actually. Sometimes it goes over 60% or so. So, we are not absolutely sure how accurate are those statistics. Nevertheless, yes, most of them give Enrique Peña Nieto they say Enrique Peña Nieto is well ahead of López Obrador, and there seems to be a general sense that actually the PRI is going to win again. I'm not sure about that. I'd say we've been seeing a lot of things happening lately that show, or at least suggest us to read this conjecture in a different light, I guess.
Well, in terms of elections being stolen, of course, there's a history of that going back to 1988 when Cárdenas clearly won and Salinas and the PRI stole the election and they cut the power off and stopped the vote count. And before they did that, Cárdenas was ahead, and then after the power was cut off and the vote count stopped, suddenly the PRI were ahead. It's been pretty cynical. The following election after that, where Cárdenas ran again, I think the Zapatistas in many ways sabotaged that with Comandante Marcos basically suggesting that Cárdenas was a weakling, and that wasn't particularly helpful.
Then
we have in the last election, López Obrador really feeling it was stolen and then having a kind of mounting a kind of citizen's sit-in for some time afterwards. I'm not sure that helped his cause. He's now saying that things have changed. In 2006, we lacked organization, but now we're organized. So what about the integrity of the vote? My understanding is that the Mexican voting system is actually infinitely better than the one we have here in the United States.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Well, you know, there seems to be, I mean, one thing that it's certainly, if we compare the current election with the other, with the past ones, is that the level of uncertainty in many ways, at least socially speaking, is higher, definitely. Partly because there's huge sectors of the population that actually are not trusting the government office for elections, the Instituto Federal Electoral, there seems to be a lot of, you know, reasonable doubts about the integrity of the whole system. We've been hearing in the past 2 weeks, at least, lots of, you know, irregularities going on around PRI people allegedly trying to buy votes of lots of people in Mexico across the country. It seems to be, you know, kind of contradictory what I'm saying, but what I'm trying to explain here is that on the one hand, in institutional terms, the El Instituto Federal Electoral, the body in charge of, you know, managing the whole elections, is getting, in a way, more effective, more efficient, more transparent, definitely. So in that sense, I'd say we have certainly more, sure, more certainty about this. But at the same time, there seems to be a genuine, you know, doubt, generally speaking, about how the different parties are actually behaving, trying to get the voters to benefit, sure, to actually give them the vote.
Well, I think what I was saying, Dr. Andre Dorce Ramos, is that in terms of counting the vote, there's more integrity, but not in terms of buying the vote. That's a separate issue.
Exactly.
And the PAN have just accused the PRI of candidate Enrique Peña Nieto's campaign of acquiring 9,500 prepaid gift cards worth nearly 5.2 million to give away to get people to vote for them. That's an old PRI trick.
Yes.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Andre Dorce Ramos, who's a lecturer of research in the Communication Sciences Department of the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico. He's also the ombudsman with Public Broadcasting Channel 22. Now, tell us about the television side of it, the idea. We have Fox News here, which is essentially the Pravda of the Republican Party. You have Azteca and Televisa, which has about 95% of the media footprint in Mexico, completely in the pocket of the PRI. For an American audience, that would be like, we have nothing but Fox News here, if you're, say, a Democrat, you know?
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think, in a way, yes, that analogy actually is pretty good. I'd say that there's a slight difference in terms of how Televisa actually got emerged 50 or so years ago in Mexico. It's been historically it's been linked to the Mexican government over the last 70 something years. So first it was a radio broadcaster, and then it became television in the 1950s. So it was always very close. It had always a very kind of a instrumental relationship with the PRI until 2000, and so it's sometimes at some points it's very difficult actually to distinguish or try to find what are the differences between some factions of the PRI and Televisa. Of course, it's a private enterprise. Of course, it's not the same, but I'd say they are organically collaborating for a very, very long period of time. So yes, it's like having only Fox News, basically. So, yes, we have a huge problem in terms of the way in which democracy is run in Mexico, the role that the television actually is playing. We have this huge, basically, monopoly in television sector and telecommunications as well.
Well, tell us about the Yo Soy 132 movement. We heard from a spokesperson for a young activist with Yo Soy 132. They're trying to level the playing field through social media. We saw that happen in Egypt with the Arab Spring. Give us a sense of how deep the penetration is for the internet and whether the students are talking to a broader swath of people, certainly not on the level that Televisa has in terms of its big microphone.
Yes, of course. You have to take into account that Mexico, we are like 112 million people, basically. Television has reaches about 99% of the Mexican population. The internet, only 30% of Mexican people have access to the internet. And that's certainly a huge gap in terms of access to information, to access to the news, and many other things, education as well. So you have to take that into account. Now, what's interesting about I Am 132, or Yo Soy 132, is that they are not only working in a sort of in the cyberspace. They also work in the streets. They are organizing different types of groups across the country. So they have a very good communication, not only through social media, the social networks, etc., Facebook, Twitter, etc., but they also are, you know, managing to communicate with many other people that don't have access to the internet, and that's absolutely essential in terms of their own objectives. And I'd say they're definitely expressing something new in terms of how younger citizens are relating to the media, and their opposition to Televisa. It's been quite a surprise, actually.
Well, any last thoughts here before we close out? I know that the election, the count won't be in until tomorrow, but just what's your final comment on today's historic elections? That maybe.
Well, definitely, I think it's historic. There's been a lot of fear about violence coming, you know, expressing itself in some ways. There's been some violence in some parts of the country, but until now, everything seems to be calm and going just fine. I'd say the levels of uncertainty we're having or witnessing now are also, I think, they indicate the complexity of this process. So I think basically what I'm trying to say is that anything can happen. I wouldn't agree to say that the PRI, Enrique Peña Nieto, is going to win like a landslide. I don't think so. I think it's going to be a very tight competition. So we must be ready to face whatever it happens. I think both Andrés Manuel López Obrador and Enrique Peña Nieto have a chance to actually win.
Well, just in closing, Dr. André Dorce Ramos, there's, of course, 79 million voters voting today for the presidency, the six-year term, as well as 500 congressional deputies and 128 senators, and 11 of the 30, there are races in six of Mexico's 31 states for governorships. The PRI haven't really gone away. If they come back in a big way, do you think, the most of the coverage here in the United States is about the war on drugs, which is should be acknowledged by all as a complete failure, and that essentially Mexico is paying the price for the fact that Americans consume drugs.
That's and selling arms as well.
And selling arms. And, of course, they just censured the to hold in contempt of Congress the Attorney General, a vote organized by the NRA, the very people that are responsible for allowing allowing guns to go into Mexico. The whole thing here is an obscene, hypocritical circus. What's your sense of what will happen to the war on drugs if the PRI come back?
Well, there seems to be the common knowledge, almost commonsensical feel that the PRI has historically has negotiated with the drug cartels. So there seems to be like a lot of hope that if the PRI actually wins the presidency, they will definitely mobilize all the political structures that they usually have in the federal government to actually reach some sort of agreement with the most violent cartels. That seems to be the expectation for a lot of people. I don't think that is possible because it seems to me, well, not only to me, for many other analysts as well, that the most of the drug cartels are now very divided in very small groups or cells. So there's no that does seem to be a centralized power. So it's going to be very difficult for whoever wins this election to actually bring up some peace to these social processes. But I do think there's going to be a huge difference in terms of how they approach the problem. Certainly, López Obrador is trying to focus more on social justice instead of only, preventive or, aggressive kind of stand like the one is favoring Presidente Calderón. What I'm saying is they're trying to, as far as I know, they are proposing a far more holistic or complete kind of measures or policies to try to solve this problem. But it's a huge one. So whoever wins, they have a huge challenge, because we definitely are in a you know, political and social crisis, and that has to be taken into account in trying to come up with some sort of solution.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Andre Dorsey Ramos.
Well, yeah, and thank you very much for having me, and wish you the best of luck, and we'll talk to you later.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Andre Dorsey Ramos, who's a lecturer of research at the Communication Sciences Department in the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico. He researches the media and political culture, and he's a member of the executive board of the Union of Socially Committed Scientists, where he coordinates the Media and Communication Group. He's also the ombudsman with Public Broadcasting Channel 22. And is currently working on a book about critical perspectives on media convergence, collaborating with several local and regional initiatives for a progressive change in media legislation in Mexico. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more from Mexico.
Politic needs votes. Politic needs your mind. Politic needs human beings. Politic needs lies. That's why.
Nos manejan mal.
Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, 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 gimme todo el poder. So I can come around to poder. Dame, 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 dame todo el power.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Grayson, who's a professor of comparative politics at the College of William and Mary. He has written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community, and The New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador. And his latest book is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. He is a scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Grayson.
Very nice to be with you.
And tell us about the role of how much the war on drugs, brutal and bloody as it is in Mexico, with up to 60,000 casualties so far of the war on drugs, which is largely to do with American consumption, but the Mexicans are really the ones that are fighting and dying in this war on drugs. And of course, not only do we consume the drugs here in the United States, we also provide the firearms with which the Mexican cartels murdering each other and innocent civilians. I take it, though, that in this particular election, more pocketbook issues are dominating, not the war on drugs.
No, the number one issue are the drug-related deaths. And that's been the kiss of death for the National Action Party, the PAN, which is the party of outgoing President Felipe Calderón. His party's been in power 12 years, and the people now want change, 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 and they want a mitigation, if not the end, to the bloodshed.
So you're saying that pocketbook issues aren't dominating, that the war on drugs is really the key issue?
Well, pocketbook issues come in a close second, because despite the fact that there has been economic stability during the PAN 12-year rule, The people know that the income distribution is highly skewed, and about a third of the population live as old rag pickers in fetid slums. And those people are going to vote against the PAN and probably vote for the PRI, which was once the dominant party in the country for 71 years until the PAN took power in 2000.
So is this a case of the failure of the PAN? They replaced the 71-year rule of the PRI. There was a lot of hope and expectation with Vicente Fox. He, of course, addressing the one-third of the population that live in poverty that you just referenced, George Grayson, he promised to create 10 million new jobs. And, of course, the joke became, he sure created 10 million new jobs, Vincente Fox. The only problem was they were all in America because there was a massive exodus. So tell me about how much what's happening today in Mexico is a result of the failure of the PAN to deliver.
That's the perception. And it turned out that Fox was a great campaigner, but that he couldn't organize a one-car funeral. And there were great expectations when Felipe Calderon won 6 years ago because he was a much more experienced politician. But he has handled the economic issues well, but it is virtually impossible to win a drug war unless you've got the full cooperation of the country's elite, and that hasn't been forthcoming.
Well, there's an expectation, is there not, that if the PRI wins, and there's more than just the presidential elections, there's the Congress and six of 31 governorships, which are very key in Mexico. The expectation is that the PRI will make a deal with the cartels.
The PRI can't make a national deal as they used to do 20 or 25 years ago because there are too many cartels now. But I wouldn't be surprised if many of the 20 PRI governors who up to this date have often worked hand in glove with the cartels or have turned a blind eye to the cartel violence, I suspect many of them will reach some kind of local accords.
So is there any way then obviously that I mentioned the war on drugs being largely an American problem in as much as where the destination of these drugs, because it's American drug consumers that are driving the market. We also have, of course, this situation here in the United States where there's virtually no gun control, particularly in Arizona and the border states, where massive amounts of firearms across the border. We've had this absolutely absurd and obscene theater at the United States Congress where the Attorney General, there was a vote to hold him in contempt of Congress organized by the NRA, the very people who have stripped any meaningful gun laws out to the point where guns flow across the border, you know, 50 caliber sniper rifles, machine guns, AK-47s, you name it, unfettered. So from the Mexican point of view, they feel pretty burned up. And you mentioned Calderon, the outgoing president. He spoke very passionately to the United States Congress, the very same body that just voted in this this piece of absurd theater to hold the Attorney General in contempt. He spoke very passionately to the same body, and obviously they didn't listen.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. The NRA and its 20 allied groups are a political powerhouse, and so we're not going to get strict curbs on gun flows. But even if you stopped every weapon crossing the border into Mexico, the cartels have sufficient funds to buy arms on the international market. The Chinese, for example, make an excellent knockoff of the AK-47. So it would be a thorn in the side, but not a bullet in the heart, if the flow of guns north to south were terminated.
So is there therefore no solution apart from the fact that the American consumers give up drugs, which is highly unlikely?
Well, it's going to have to be Mexican leadership. The U.S. can only do so much to help with the local war against drugs here. And we can offer technical assistance, intelligence, and some hardware. But the Mexicans are going to have to rein in their governors, who are often accomplices in the drug trade. They're going to have to crack down on money laundering, because you can buy just about anything with cash here. And they're also going to have to develop more professional law enforcement bodies because there are virtually no honest police in Mexico. So we bear part of the blame, but the Mexicans have to take the lead in reducing the bloodshed.
Well, there's an expression, I believe, in Mexico, plomo y plata, which means silver or lead. In other words, you take a bribe or you take a bullet. And if you're a law enforcement officer in Mexico, underpaid in a country that is poor and that where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, you can understand the temptation that the choice is either you take a lot of money, the more that you can ever earn legitimately from the cartel, to buy protection and to serve their interests, or alternatively, if you're an honest and courageous policeman, you're likely to get killed. I mean, it's pretty grim, isn't it?
You know, the hope is that back in the old days of the pre, there were constraints on the drug capos. That is, they were allowed to conduct their business, but if they broke unwritten rules of the game, that the shadowy forces from Mexico City would come down on them like a ton of bricks. Now, because so many of the governors are complicit in the drug trade, it's going to be incumbent upon Peña Nieto, if he does emerge as president of the PRI, to rein in the 20 PRI governors and make it clear to them that cooperation with the cartels is absolutely unacceptable.
But the group that you've written about, George Grayson, in your new book, The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They've Created, the Zetas, they come out of military intelligence, and a lot of them are former police officers. They have literally pushed the envelope in terms of brutality to the points of incomprehensibility. I mean, you can't put that kind of violence back in a bottle, can you?
Absolutely not. And even if you eliminated the drug trafficking completely, groups like Los Zetas have become experts in kidnapping, in extortion, in smuggling immigrants into the United States, in money laundering, in loan sharking, in prostitution. So there's a sub-layer of criminality that will exist even if the Virgin of Guadalupe should reappear and the cartels should no longer be able to export their products.
So how does Mexico's elite, one of the richest men in the world, Carlos Slim Alou, is a Mexican businessman who owns the telephone and media and internet monopoly. How do the elite, the oligarchs who are backing Peña Nieto, and the media, Televisa and Azteca are their mouthpiece, how do they feel about this country of theirs that is being racked by this kind of brutal crime? I mean, they all have bodyguards, but you'd think that that somewhere in their souls they would recognize that this is no way to live.
What we found in Colombia was the elite were also cocooned, thanks to bodyguards, sophisticated electronic security devices, skilled drivers, sending their children abroad to study, and sometimes operating their business from the United States. It was only when the Medellin cartel in Colombia moved from criminal violence to terrorism, that is, bombing shopping centers, shooting planes out of the air, killing a presidential candidate, that the elite had an epiphany, that they had a stake in fighting organized crime. Now, the elite in the north, in cities like Monterrey, has had this epiphany, but it still hasn't occurred with regard to the well-to-do in Mexico City, Guadalajara, Cuernavaca, and in other cities. And they really have to commit themselves to fighting organized crime.
Well, George Grayson, it's a pretty grim picture, don't you think? And this election might end up, if indeed it goes as planned, if I can use that word, with the PRI taking over, it's not likely to get better. I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with George Gratian. He's a professor of comparative politics at the College of William and Mary. He's written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community and the New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and his latest, The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. He is a scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. Let's now turn to Anne-Marie O'Connor, who writes for the Washington Post from Mexico City, where her husband, William Booth, is the Washington Post bureau chief. Previously, she was a foreign correspondent for Reuters and a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times for 12 years. She's the author of the new book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Marie O'Connor.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Anne-Marie, recently you wrote a profile in the Washington Post on the PRD candidate López Obrador. Obviously, there's a lot of people in Mexico and supporters here in the United States, particularly at this radio station, who are really hoping that he gets elected. It feels a little bit like tilting at windmills, right, given the power of the control of the media that the PRI have with, you know, they've overspent their campaign by $330 million in terms of the funds, and apparently they've been secretly buying favorable coverage from Mexico's television giant Televisa. So what's your reading on the conditions now in terms of the likely outcome of this vote?
Well, obviously, López Obrador, it remains extremely popular. He came within a sliver of a percentage of winning in 2006. He tried fraud when he didn't win. At this point, Peña Nieto, the candidate of the former ruling party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, with the soap opera Good Looks and the soap opera star wife, has a double-digit lead and has maintained that now for some time. Now, there's a very large percentage of undecided voters and supporters of López Obrador are hoping that there might be a last-minute upset. And when we start getting poll results in, we will see if he has managed to increase his support in the vote.
Well, it's the we spoke earlier with the Yoso 132 representative who emceed the big silent protest in the Zocalo last night. What kind of influence are they having on the political center, if that's the right description? They have alternative media, the internet, but I understand internet penetration in Mexico is about 30%. Largely with the middle class, and this feels a bit like a middle class student movement, Yoso 132. I don't think it's fair to compare it to the Arab Spring, which was a much more diverse movement.
Well, the Yoso 132 movement is being handicapped quite a bit by the types of social inequities that they are protesting. There's a very, very small number of, only several million young Mexicans are actually in higher education of some kind. There's not enough of them to make a widespread movement out of a university movement, and the movement hasn't spread out of the universities yet. So it is not the kind of widespread movement that you're seeing in Chile, where there are many students in universities, or in the Middle East, where it has spread throughout the society. It's really not fair to compare them to that. However, they have succeeded in putting a number of very important issues on the table in Mexico, such as the monopolies on media that they are now complaining about Televisa and Teleazteca's sort of hold on the political debate. They accuse Televisa of supporting Peña Nieto, and they charge that Televisa's journalism has a hidden agenda that actually makes it a bit of electoral propaganda in his favor. So they are trying to get many of these issues on the table that could have an impact in future elections. But at this point, many analysts say they actually have not influenced the polls.
Well, of course, there is a history of the PRI, who look like they're making a comeback, stealing elections. In 1988, they stole the presidential election. Cardenas was ahead in the count, and then the PRI cut off the power and stopped the count. And then when the power came back on, suddenly the count changed, and the PRI won, and Salinas became the president. And then 6 years later, in 1994, Cardenas ran again. This time, in many ways, his presidential hopes were scuttled by the Zapatistas, who basically humiliated him and called him a kind of a weakling, and Subcomandante Marcos became a hero, overshadowing him, the Zapatista leader, who apparently Oliver Stone can hang out with him, but somehow the Mexican authorities can't arrest him. The long and the short of it is that they have every reason to be bitter. Last time around, López Obrador felt that he won, and it was stolen again. And then he mounted a kind of sit-in in response to it. What's your understanding about him? Because he didn't do that well in the debates, which would have been a good chance to have put his best face forward. What's his problem with winning the elections but not being able to win over the people?
Well, one of the problems in general in the presidential elections has been Peña Nieto's capability of looking presidential. He doesn't say much, and people don't really know where he stands on many issues, but people think he looks presidential on television. He has that kind of rare telegenic quality for many people. Josefina Vázquez Mota, of course, is running against her party's record, which is Calderón's drug war. And more than 50,000 people have died since 2007, by some counts, 57,000. But however you count it, it's been a very, very violent presidential time. 47 journalists have disappeared or been murdered. Now, with López Obrador, what seems to be holding him back, according to his own supporters, is his baggage. His baggage from when he was declared the loser, he believes by fraud, in 2006. And his supporters took to the streets and shut down the main artery in Mexico City, Avenida La Reforma, for weeks and weeks with protests. Many people get fired from their jobs in the hotels along La Reforma and in bars. It was a very unpopular demonstration. And to many people, that hurt his chances now. He didn't look as if he had the maturity to govern. However, there's a question about why he hasn't done better in a Latin America that has been very successfully governed by the left in recent decades. Lula lifted millions of people out of poverty in Brazil. There have been left-of-center leaders elected all over Latin America, and they have gotten very high marks in governance and in addressing the long-standing social issues that hold Latin America back. So many people asked why he didn't do better in this last election.
And what conclusions did you come to from profiling him, Anne Marie O'Connor?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of speculation here. One thing that people say is that if the very popular Mexico City mayor from the same party, from the Democratic Revolutionary Party, Marcelo Ebrard, had run, he would have won as president because Mexico City has been very successfully governed by the Democratic Revolutionary Party for many years now, including by López Obrador, who received, when he was mayor here, 84% approval ratings. It may be true what some analysts say, including in his own party, that the way he handled the refusal to acknowledge him as president the last time he ran, he believed by fraud, he lost by such a tiny percent, that may be holding him back now.
Well, just in closing, Anne Marie O'Connor, the previous guest, George Grayson, suggested that we talked about the war on drugs or the failed war on drugs that cost Mexico 60,000 lives. He suggested that the real problem is, as at is at the gubernatorial level, and there are quite a number of pre-governors in the state, and that that's where the real corruption is. Is that your understanding? That, in other words, it may, you know, the U.S. will probably weigh in with the pre-president about the war on drugs, but he may not be the real guy to talk with.
Well, you know, a lot of people talk about the pre-structure having remained intact in Mexico. And many analysts say that if that's true, where it is, as where the pre has remained intact is in the provincial areas where they hold the governorships and many of the posts outside of the capital. Now, within the capital itself, and within this area, a lot of the pre-dinosaurs have switched parties. So they're now in the PAN or in the PRD, or they've gone where the action is. How much influence this has had on the current election is hard to say, because the PRI has now been out of power for many years.
Well, they still seem to have the kind of rural network that they had, that they've kept intact. They may not be popular with the students, but as you pointed out, there aren't enough students going to into higher education, which in itself is it shows the problem in Mexico. The long and the short of it is that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer in that country. And you have one of the richest men in the world, a Mexican, Carlos Slim Alou. So I'm just, you know, astounded that the elite in that country could be comfortable with this situation, that they clearly...
Well, that is what the Yo Soy 132 student movement says, that governments have come and gone without touching many of the very intact monopolies and power structures that have to be changed for Mexico to truly democratize.
So that's the real message here. And do you think that message is going to resonate past the election, that maybe the student movement is the beginning of a broader movement?
Well, that is what people are waiting to see, because the problems that they are pointing out remain in their eyes. They are drawing up a broader agenda that they say that they will hand to the president-elect in December. If they maintain this movement to draw attention to these issues, there may be more pressure to change in Mexico.
So do you think that there's any way that this could be achieved? I mean, how do you... I mean, we in America seem in many ways heading towards oligarchical rule too. I guess I'm asking you a very it's a difficult question here. How does democracy reverse oligarchy?
Well, I think it's a question that's being asked now all over the world. Look at the Occupy movement. Look at the movements in the Middle East. People are watching television and demanding a broader democratization. They're seeing freedoms in other countries or in other places, or freedom of speech in the media, and they are demanding their own voice. And I think this is a worldwide trend. And at the same time, there does seem to be entrenched power. Probably there always has been. I think people are just more aware of it now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Mexico City, Anne-Marie O'Connor.
Well, thank you so much for having me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Anne-Marie O'Connor, who writes for The Washington Post from Mexico City, where her husband, William Booth, is the Washington Post bureau chief. Previously, she was a foreign correspondent for Reuters and a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times for 12 years. She's the author of the new book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece Portrait, Adele Bloch Bauer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing throughout the week, Monday through Thursday. Join me. Bye for now.